Macabrepedia makes light of dark subject matter that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
West Memphis, Arkansas, May 5th, 1993. At 6:30 p.m., Terry Hobbs, the stepfather of 8-year-old Stevie Branch, was seen yelling for Stevie and his two friends to go home. By 7 p.m. that same night, Mark Byers called the police to report that his 8-year-old son, Christopher Byers, hadn't come home. The three young friends would disappear that night. On May 6, 1993, the bodies of the three boys were found naked, beaten, and hogtied with their own shoelaces. The bodies had been dumped in a creek bed. Stevie Branch and Michael Moore showed signs of being beaten, but were found to have died from drowning. The third, Christopher Byers, had died from his injuries, which included possible bite marks, laceration, blunt trauma, and a de-skinning of his genitals. The list of suspects would range from a local ice cream truck driver, a blood-covered man at a local fast food restaurant, and the children's parents themselves, all before resting heavily on three teenaged boys who were accused of committing the crime as part of a satanic ritual. Join us as we add another entry into this, our Macabrepedia.
Hello, and welcome to Macabrepedia, a marriage of true crime and the truly bizarre. We are your hosts, Marissa and Matthew, and that sounds really terrible, and sounds like we are continuing our Satanic Panic series.
Yeah, really terrible is kind of what we do here at Macabrepedia.
Yeah, but there's levels.
Yeah, well, this is a crime that does involve some children. Violence. And I think we're going to have to take a break from children violence for a while.
I think so. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a lot of crimes that involve children get a lot of attention, right? I mean, because they're, you know.
Because of how dark and terrible they are.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. In this particular crime, this is known as the West Memphis Three. The West Memphis Three are actually the perpetrators or the alleged perpetrators to the crime. That would be Jesse Miskelly, Damian Eccles, and James Baldwin, three teenage boys who were connected to very loosely connected to. By very loosely, I mean literally no evidence to connect them to the murder of three 8-year-old boys, Stevie Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers.
Okay. So explain to me why they were involved with this.
Well, because it's a small town and it's a Christian, God-fearing kind of town. So the behaviors of some of these youthful rapscallions, these three teenagers, started to get, you know, some attention, particularly like the leader of their little band, their little group, Damian Eccles, was known for being into the occult. He had, recently, prior to this, this crime, he had been in a mental hospital. This is all stuff that would come out during their trial more so than anything else. What actually gets them kind of linked to it, I don't really know. I don't know the spark that got them pinpointed as the culprits. There's nothing there. Eventually, what would happen is Jesse Miskelly would give a confession to the crime.
Well, that'll link you to it.
Yes, but Jesse had an IQ reportedly of 70 to 72.
So pretty low.
He eventually was brought in by police and interrogated for 12 hours. only like 40-ish minutes of it was actually recorded. And even in this 40-ish minute long recorded confession, you can still hear the direction and the leading of the suspect from the police or from the interrogator.
They did this last week and stuff last week too. Just very much leading the
children. Well, I mean, if you have a hypothesis as an interrogator.
Yeah, you want to get that. You don't want to get to that.
Yeah, so you kind of, you kind of push the story a little bit, but you're not supposed to.
No, I mean, I get it, but it's not effective and it can lead to somebody confessing to something that they didn't do.
Right. And in this case, Jesse would admit guilt in the crime, as well as he would implicate the other two boys in this crime as well. And in the confession, he would, you can tell that he's being led a bit, because even the time frame in which it happens is being led by the interrogator, which Miss Kelly eventually or initially says that he implies, without actually saying, that it's earlier in the afternoon when this happens. And then the investigator would ask something along the lines of like, so after school? And he would say, yes, after school.
Right. Yeah.
And then the interrogator would say, well, what happened that night? So now it went from sometime in the afternoon to after school to now at night.
That night, yeah.
Which he never said that it was at night. And the way that he seems to be delivering this is that he's guessing, right? And this is, again, 12 hours of interrogation for a 40-minute confession conversation. Definitely makes it seem like there is quite a bit left out there. And they would later say that this was – that he had knowledge of the crime that he couldn't have known any other way. Well, he could if you led him that way and you gave him that information, you asked those right questions, and you have nothing to record, no recording showing where you did that part. You know, there's some questions to be had there. The police would then... There was also, according to some sources, there were police that had... heard that other people had overheard Damien Eccles claiming that he had done this crime, and that the police had then tried to bug an area, like bug a house, and then have the three boys go to this house, and they try to get this person who had made this claim try to weasel out a confession from him, which never happened. Now the police say, according to the sources, that it was inaudible, so you couldn't tell what they were saying. Another person who was the person who was trying to get the confession out of him said that nothing was actually said, but it was enough that she did testify against them at some point. So did her
that she didn't hear anything.
Son. No, she testified against them that she did hear, and there was a lot of people who testified, not a lot, but there were people who testified against them saying, "Oh, I heard Damien telling somebody that he killed those boys." And the defense said, "Okay, what did he say right before that?" And they're like, "Oh." And they're like, "What did he say right after that?" "Oh, I don't know."
So you just happened to walk in right at the right moment for him to confess to that.
Yep, that exact moment you heard that, the two sentences, yeah, where he was just happened to be bragging at a baseball or whatever. I think it was some sporting event, bragging about this. And you happen to overhear, and these are like other kids that are on trial or that are testifying against them and stuff. And this can all be seen in an HBO documentary called Paradise Lost. It's a 3-part documentary that takes place over like 20 years because it follows their whole story. So after the boys go missing. So we're backing up a little bit. After the boys go missing, so we're back at like May 5th, the night of May 5th into May 6th, there is a search party that goes out and starts to look for the boys. And this is a pretty intensive search party, pulling in, you know, volunteers from around the area, as well as police and everything. And they're doing this search. And during this search, Terry Hobbs, which is Stevie Branch's stepfather, he comes home and then says that he's going to go get his friend David Jacoby. Hobbs goes to Jacoby's house, where they hang out and play guitar together for a while. Meanwhile, his stepson is missing.
Yeah.
And there's a search happening. Then at some point, Terry Hobbs says, I think it's time to go ahead and go help with the search.
You think?
Yeah. So he then leaves Jacoby to go change his clothes to go out for the search party. Nobody in the search ever says that Terry ever shows up, which is a little unusual.
For sure.
There would also later, much later, there would be stories saying that Terry had cleaned, around the time of the crime, he had cleaned Stevie's room, taking all of the bed linens off and washing them. He even washed their curtains and stuff. Like,
all right, well, this guy did it.
Some pretty unusual behaviors.
No, this is it.
Never a suspect. He's never
wrong,
a suspect.
Wrong.
Well, there are people who speculate that it was Terry Hobbs. It is a possibility.
Well, it definitely seemed suspicious that he did that.
Yeah, so there are some things that point to Terry as being a possible suspect. He's never tried as a suspect. There are, like I said, there's a number of suspects. And another one of the fathers, who is Mark Byers, the adopted father of Christopher Byers, he is kind of put on as a suspect. After the bodies were found, one of the things that were found, a marking that was found on them, was a belt buckle mark from getting hit with a belt buckle.
Okay.
It was known that he had, spanked, Christopher with a belt prior to him going out that night. So there is also some stuff that leads towards him. Later, and more information would come out that would also kind of link him to a possible something suspicious. Was that in this was never brought up in the initial trial, I don't believe, but in which happens in 1994, in like 1996, 97, Mark Byers would get all of his teeth removed after. There was speculation that Christopher Byers, I believe it was Christopher Byers, had bite marks on him. And suddenly Mark gets all of his teeth taken out. He would claim that it was because he takes seizure medicines that were causing tooth decay, as well as he's known that a lot of these people seem very much into drug and alcohol abuse.
Okay, well. Which does affect your teeth.
Right. But. So there, and he said that he had chronic issues with his teeth. He got them all removed and got dentures.
Well, the timing does seem a little suspicious, though.
It is a little suspicious that right before they start taking molds of the West Memphis Three's teeth to try to compare it to this, somebody else goes and gets his teeth taken out. Also, another thing that links him to it was during the filming of the documentary for HBO, Paradise Lost. He gave one of the cameramen a knife, like a hunting knife. And the cameraman, for reasons I'm not exactly sure how it all came out, found that there was possible blood or human tissue or tissue on the knife, which... Mr. Byers said had never been used. The HBO producers were like, you bring that right back now. You know, like you do. No. That is evidence. So, it is tested. It turns out that there, it is blood. They bring this up to, Mr. Byers during a questioning during the trials. And he says that it's venison from when he was carving up a deer.
Did they have enough to test to see if it was human tissue?
They did. And then they said, well, that's all fine and good. You said they'd never been used. Now you're saying you cleaned a deer with it. And it turns out, and he's like, well, I used it once. And he says, well, it's blood, human blood.
Oh.
And he says, well, maybe I cut myself when I was doing it. And he says, well, it matches yours and Christopher's blood type. Now, this isn't like a strict DNA testing where they can show all of the stuff for the DNA, but they can tell that it's the same type of blood. And they happen to, they're not biologically related, but they do share the same
blood type. Right.
So a little bit weird. He said, well, maybe he cut himself with it and may have left it open. And that kind of just goes on by.
And nobody follows up on that.
No, not really. I'm telling you, it's really weird how some of the stuff is. There's also at the same time, there's, on May 5th, 1993, at about it specifically says 8:42 PM, but, we'll say around that time, the night that the boys go missing, a man comes into a Bojangles, which for those who are not in an area where there's Bojangles, it's a Kentucky Fried Chicken kind of fried chicken place. Local fast food restaurant. A man comes in. He's wearing a sling around his arm, and he goes into the bathroom where he apparently is bleeding or cleaning up blood or something. They go in and they check on him, and he's just like sitting in a stall, like bleeding. They call the police. Mm-hmm. The man leaves. The police come there. Nobody thinks that this is connected because it's a little bit further away from the crime scene. Still in the area. It's just like a jurisdiction, or not a jurisdiction, but a whatever their area of influence.
But easily drivable.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And they take blood samples from this location. The police do. And conveniently lose it. And they're like, wow.
Okay.
And while the investigator is on trial or being questioned by the defense, he says, well, what happened to the blood samples that were supposed to be tested? What did they find? And he says, I lost the samples. And he's like, you lost the samples. And he's like, yep. And he's like, just don't know what happened to them. Now, this is a pretty small town that doesn't have like these like state of the art. This isn't Bones, mm-hmm. you know, by Bones, I mean the TV
show.
This isn't like where they're dealing with all this high tech stuff. I mean, they're keeping evidence in like grocery bags from the local grocery stores and stuff like that. Like they are not prepared to deal with a adolescent triple homicide in this area. So that was another suspect. There was also a couple of suspects who had at least passingly known the three boys, one of which had been arrested for moving drugs and he had also run an ice cream truck through the neighborhood. And so he was a little bit of a suspect for a moment and pretty much got off almost immediately. So let's go back to Jesse Miss Kelly's confession.
Yeah.
This is the main thing that gets them. He goes, he spends the day getting, pressured by police to give this confession. And he gives a confession. It seems very much leading. He says he makes all kinds of claims about them all taking turns sodomizing the kids and all this stuff. And it's basically he confesses to everything, and it seems very much like if the police ask if it happened, he's like, yes, it did. And, you know, and all this. So he just gives it all out there. He then recants the confession at a later date. He ends up, because of this confession, he ends up getting tried separately from the other two because there's laws against confessions that also implicate other people as well as themselves and whatever. So he gets tried by himself, is found guilty, and gets a life sentence. The other two, James Baldwin and Damien Eccles, which Damien, actually, he chose his name to be Damien because he's into occult stuff. He's got, like, you know, the black, very black hair and stuff like that. And he's practices Wicca, and he's very much into this kind of spirituality, occultism. He uses, enigmas and ciphers, that are from arcane, like, Aleister Crowley kind of workbooks and stuff like that. And he's very much into magic and all that.
Yeah. And unfortunately that probably made him more of a target.
Hugely so.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And he'd been arrested previously for, like, breaking, entering, burglary, stuff like that. So he ends up getting put on trial, and he had previously been in a mental hospital where he had made claims of gaining power through the drinking of blood and stuff like that. And they said that he has, like, some kind of audio visual delusion, kind of like possible borderline schizophrenia kind of a thing. But he does kind of have this air of superiority all the time. Mm-hmm. Not in, like, he seems like a perfectly fine person, but he kind of always looks like, even when he was like 16, 17, whenever this happened, he kind of holds himself in a way that he always looks like he's posing for an album cover, you know, like he always looks like,
yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
too cool, you know, but when he's on the stand, he does seem kind of distant, when they're asking him questions. And according to if you watch his testimony, he does kind of paint himself into a couple of corners throughout his testimony. Long story short, the two of them are found guilty. James Baldwin gets life, and Eccles is given the death penalty.
No way.
Yeah. So.
Wow.
Yeah. So pretty unlucky, being that they have nothing.
Yeah, no evidence is what you're saying.
Yeah. And they can't use the confession that Miss Kelly gave in order to bring it up in court.
That's super harsh.
Yeah. So they end up getting this penalty. So let's fast forward a few years. The 1996 happens with the tooth and stuff. And they're trying to get appeals. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get a retrial, all this stuff. There is some issues with also during the initial trial that there was, an issue with the, jury foreman kind of leading the judge, and the judge and him having kind of like a little bit off colored conversation about the outcome of whatever the jury says. So it was a little bit of an exchange about, you know, what happens. The judge said something about them having to go get lunch before the reading of the sentence or something like that, which that implies that the judge is expecting a
lunch with the juror.
He said, you guys should go get lunch. Tell the jury to go get lunch before the reading of the sentence.
Oh, okay.
Which implies that he is going to be sentencing them.
Yeah.
Without actually having the jury tell them if they're convicted.
Yeah. So he has to have had some insight.
It shows a bias, yeah, if nothing else. So that's unusual. And that was never reported. I don't know exactly how trustworthy that is. I found it in a spot. But there was also the handling of the evidence. There was when the bodies were found, they were immediately pulled out of the water. Their bikes, cause they had been riding bikes, their bikes were found, on a bank, near the river. But they had been pulled out as well and placed there. So the police had gone in there and tampered with the whole site before the coroner ever got there. So the coroner gets there and everything's been trampled on and all this stuff is all over the place. And, the whole crime scene was just immediately just destroyed before the coroner ever got there. Now, so obviously all the evidence has been kind of, I don't want to say tampered with, but not handled properly. Again, it's a small force. They don't really know exactly what to do. They find a body, get the body, you know?
Right.
You know. So a bunch of stuff just wasn't really falling into place quite properly there. And then there was in 2007. So now we're jumping a bit far ahead. There was extra DNA testing that was available in 2007, where they were able to pull some DNA evidence from the crime scene, including a hair that was from David Jacoby, Terry Hobbs's friend that he was playing guitar with. Mm-hmm. Now, David Jacoby says it makes sense that his hair would be found there because he did go out and do this for the search party after Terry had left. Terry never showed up. David apparently did. And he said he was searching in that area. So it makes sense that his hair, one of his hairs may have been blown by the wind down to the creek and onto the bodies.
But he wasn't searching close enough to where he found the bodies.
Yeah. And it was only his hair. It was only,
nobody else's either.
One possible suspect dude's hair was blown over there. Hmm. Also, there was possible DNA evidence of Terry on the shoelaces of – now, Terry Hobbs is the stepfather of Stevie Branch. The shoelaces that had Terry's DNA on it were tied around the ankles and wrists of Christopher Byers. Terry says, well, that's because it could happen to anybody because they all hung out together. They'd been at my house. They'd been so it would only make sense that my DNA could end up on somebody's clothing or shoes or whatever. Also pretty loose. If you watch the initial behaviors of everyone in the community, they are like these three teens, they're guilty as all heck. By 2007, 2011, or 2007, 2010, Mark Byers, the guy who had the knife that had his DNA on it, he goes from in the documentary having guns and the other dads are like taking guns and shooting like pumpkins and saying the names of Damien Echols and stuff. And they're like, bah, bah. So they're like pretending to murder these teens and all
toxic
this stuff.
Masculinity.
Yeah. So they're sitting there and they're like, oh, here's one for, what are you crawling away? And they're all shooting these pumpkins and cans and stuff like that. So, and it's all, but then by 2007 through 2010, they had changed. Like Mark Byers becomes a very, very vocal person about these teens did not do it. Like they didn't do it. You have the wrong people. This is not justice. We need to get them out of there and find the real people who did this and all this stuff.
What made him change his mind?
Probably the evidence of, he straight up, and you can find this too. He straight up is like, it was Terry Hobbs. That's who did it. It was Terry Hobbs. He just looks right dead at the camera and they're like, who do you think did it? And before the guy even can finish the sentence, he's like, it was Terry Hobbs. He's like, if I didn't make that clear enough for you, I don't know what else to tell you. It was Terry Hobbs.
Well, I'm glad that he was able to move past thinking it was the teenagers. And, you know, again, I said toxic masculinity, and it is in a way that they deal with their feelings that way. But like, that was their pain also.
Sure.
You know, they didn't know how to take it out.
And to be fair on that, too, the mothers were saying similar things, that if they didn't get found guilty, that if they were ever found on the street, that they would go and they would kill
them
themselves.
And all,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there was actually this kind of a nice moment with, I think it was Michael Moore's mother in the documentary, where she's saying stuff like that, and her father is like, you can't think like that. He was like, because when you think that kind of vengeance and you hold that much hatred in your heart, it makes it so that you run the risk of not being able to go to heaven. If you were to do something like that, it would make it so you didn't go to heaven. And I'm confident that he's in heaven and I'm going to see him again because I'm going to forgive and release this so that I can go and see him again. And you need to do the same. So it's kind of like this sweet, touching little moment in there that's kind of shared there. But he becomes very vocal. Wasn't them. It's got to be Terry. And I believe I know that the Oxygen released a documentary or is in the works of a documentary. There's clips of it that are available that are called The Forgotten West Memphis 3. And the Forgotten West Memphis 3 are the actual children that, and I'll kind of touch on that in a second too. But the guy who's investigating this further, he's going around and he's trying to like interview people who, you know, were part of this whole thing. And he interviews David Jacoby, who is clearly nervous as anything, like shaking. And this is in like 2019, right? And he's like shaking and he's like tapping his feet and he's messing with his like cigarettes and all this stuff. And he's just like super fidgety. And what sticks to me is he keeps saying, like, he's like crying and stuff too. And it's like, it's so weird because even the parents aren't quite as broken up about it as he seems to be. And again, I don't know what his life was like. So I don't know if he, I don't know nothing about this guy, but something that really stuck out to me is he keeps saying, what did they see that would make it so that somebody would do this to them? What did they see? Which is this unusual thing to just draw a conclusion. Like, for, I don't think that most murders happen because somebody sees something. Most murders happen either because of some kind of personal thing or as a random act of violence. It's an attack of opportunity kind of a thing. What did they walk? Because he was saying stuff like, what did they walk up on that would lead someone to do this to them? You know, so he's implying that they saw something they weren't supposed to see, which is weird, in my opinion.
That is quite strange.
It's very unusual. It just seems, it seems to have some, it seems to have a bit of,
what do you think they saw?
It seems to me that it, he knows that they saw something.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. He knows that they saw something. If he knows that they saw something, he knows what they saw.
Hmm.
Or at least he knows.
Maybe.
Yeah. And that very much points to where a much, much better idea as to where his hair had come from. Right. Mm-hmm. So 2007, new DNA evidence comes up. Another thing that was found in the same kind of time was that Terry Hobbs also had Stevie's pocket knife. Now, Stevie was a very proud Boy Scout or Cub Scout. He, at the time of his death, he was wearing his Cub Scout uniform. So very, very proud. He's wearing his little.
So he would treasure that pocket knife.
Yeah. He was never anywhere without it. And he was very proud of being a scout and stuff. That's why he wore it when he wasn't even at the meetings and stuff like that. But Terry had Stevie's pocket knife, which seems a bit unusual. So that's another thing that points towards Terry also possibly. And I'm not trying to say he did it because as far as the case goes, those three teenagers, they did it. Found guilty. End of story. This doesn't sit well. This story doesn't sit well with some pretty big name music celebrities. So the Dixie Chicks, Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam, just a number of like celebrity musicians start to like come to their aid and start trying to, you know, drum up attention.
Media attention.
Yeah. So they're trying to drum up some attention to focus on this, some support for this. They're trying to help fund new research and new DNA testing and all this stuff. August 19th, 2011. Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly accept something called the Alford plea.
What does that mean?
So in August, so the Alford plea is a plea that allows you to claim innocence with the recognition that the prosecution has enough evidence that if there was a retrial, they would be able to convict you, which is kind of unusual, right?
So it is unusual. And from what you said, they don't have enough evidence, but okay.
They don't have enough evidence.
Yeah.
But this retrial or this plea, if they accept it, will allow them to have their sentence reduced to 18 years and 78 days, which is the amount of time that they had been in prison at the time of this offer.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you accept this plea deal, you get to go out.
Yeah.
You get to leave. And James Baldwin was very against this idea. He was like, no, retrial. Let's go to retrial. He ultimately accepted it because Damien is on death row.
Oh, yeah.
So they could go to, it's an opportunity to save him from a possible death sentence.
Yeah.
And it's his best friend. So he ultimately takes it and basically saves his friend's life. All three of them are released. They are still considered guilty of the crime. And because of this, after new DNA evidence or new DNA technology is now available, they cannot get anyone to test it and bring it to trial because judges are stating that because they're free, they can't actually claim like habeas corpus or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that they're not going to continue to keep bringing new evidence in here because it's basically case closed. So most people would agree though that there wasn't enough evidence to link them to it. So if it did go to a retrial, they probably would have been found not guilty.
But I guess if time is a factor, if you're on death row, so.
Yeah. I don't know exactly
how
that was all going down, but it also just like, why take that chance if you can save your friend's life, right?
Yeah.
So it was cool that they did that. So they are all free at this point in time, effectively. But they're still fighting for this and they're still trying to bring this stuff. But the judge isn't, well, they're not willing to retry any new DNA because as far as the case is concerned, it's over. They're guilty. They admitted it. And in doing so, with the acceptance of the Alford plea and their release, they also agree that they can't sue the state of Arkansas for wrongful imprisonment.
Right.
So they get out of jail, but even bringing the Alford plea to the table, to me, I kind of feel like Arkansas, y'all know you did this. These guys dirty.
Yeah.
You know, and you're trying to like, but you're trying to save your own ass at that point, right? So these guys are there. They are, particularly as far as I think from what I can find on like on a quick search for these guys, James Baldwin is still like heavily involved as like a director of ProclaimJustice.org. Which tries to free or exonerate, is that the right word? People who are wrongfully imprisoned.
Yeah.
And so he's part of that program as well. And then Jesse Miss Kelly went to a community college to become a mechanic or something along those lines. And Damien Eccles has kind of, you know, palled around with some of those celebrities. And depending on when you listen to this, September of 2022, he's hosting a ritual release, retreat in California, where you can join him and a writing partner to learn about magical rituals and inner consciousness and energy projection. So he's still firmly in that line.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're out. They're still upset about it. And there's doesn't really seem like they're really going to get a whole lot of closure on this. It's still obviously heavy and hangs over their life, and they're definitely very much identified by that. But yeah, you can check out the Paradise Lost series on HBO still. The Oxygen, the Forgotten West Memphis 3. The reason they're forgotten is because it's pretty much known that their killers are out there. Like, you know, and it's not the quote unquote West Memphis 3, the teens. These guys, they're not getting any justice, and neither are the West Memphis 3, because they're also preventing them from getting the justice, because they're effectively taking the fall for it, you know?
Well, yeah, not intentionally, but yeah, they
yeah,
had
yeah.
to.
Yeah, really. I'm not saying like, guys need to, there's
no, that's just so sad. I mean, the detail of that, the boy with his little Boy Scout jacket on, because he was so proud of it. Yeah. Like, that's just.
Yeah. And there's a lot more to this story as well. I do, you know, highly recommend that you guys, if anybody's out there who's interested in this, go look at some of these other sources, because it's really fascinating how mishandled this whole situation was. Just as a kind of an update, the John Mark Byers, the father of Christopher Byers, he died in 2020 in a car accident at the age of 63. And Melissa Byers, the mother of Christopher Byers, she died under somewhat suspicious circumstances. The cause of death was most likely a possible drug overdose back in 1996. Mark Byers was there, even though that they had been kind of going through some issues. She had moved back in with her parents, and she moved back in with her parents, and he showed up at one point, and during his stay there, she expired, and that was only 3 years after the death of her son. As far as like I said, with David Jacoby, a lot of the other people are in the more recent documentaries as well. So those, they have kind of their own updates for that. So you can go see those if you wish. And now we should have our theme music playing to bring us into Marissa's Macabre Minute.
Yes. So today's Macabre Minute takes us to Canada.
Ooh, a very macabre place.
Drink it fast or drink it slow, but the lips have got to touch the toe. In 1973, a former cowboy named Dick Stevenson found a jar in a cabin on the outskirts of Dawson City, Yukon. Inside the jar was alcohol and a human toe preserved within it.
Mm-hmm.
Stevenson took it to the downtown hotel, where patrons can drink out of the pickled toe jar. If you do, you get a certificate of membership to the Sour Toe Cocktail Club, which actually has approximately 9,500 members.
So not very exclusive.
Not super, but you know. The same toe is always used, well, for a while. Although it has had to be replaced a few times after accidentally being swallowed.
Blech.
Yeah.
Where are they getting all their toes?
Okay, so the replacement toes are willingly donated after being lost to inoperable corns, frostbite, a myriad of reasons for losing your toes.
Inoperable corns?
Yes.
Keep your certificate. That's,
Yep.
Inoperable corns.
Yep. Seems like they must be swallowed pretty frequently, because the first toe was swallowed in 1980, and then the second one was swallowed not long afterward. The third toe was swallowed in 1983. A lot of toes in quick succession here. It is a $2,500 fine if you swallow the toe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Enforced by who?
The
toe police?
Yeah.
Pinky toes.
I'm sure it's very various toes, because it could happen to any of your toes. Something might happen to
it. No, but you're swallowing a big toe.
That'd be gross.
That is a tough thing to do.
Yeah. The most recent toe was donated with a message that said to not wear open-toed sandals while mowing the lawn.
Yikes.
Yeah, it's good advice. The cocktail recipe is 1 ounce minimum of alcohol, 1 dehydrated toe, and garnish for courage. Mm. No, it says garnish with courage. I'm sorry. Mm. So basically just alcohol and toe.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
So
yeah. That's how toes are supposed to be taken. Straight.
That's nuts. The club has acquired over 25 toes since it's been doing this. All donated. But yeah.
I mean, if you have, I mean, you probably have a pool of certificate holders that are willing to give their toes for it.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody's been there and they're aware of it and then they have to lose their toe, they're probably like, you know what, I could do with that.
All right. No. Okay. Here's the thing. Where are they going to get their toes removed that they get to keep their toes?
Yeah. Most places won't let you keep your body parts.
I can't keep shit when I get stuff.
Yeah, I know. I don't know.
Not that I have a ton of stuff that I've ever had taken out of my body. I did get to keep a massive splinter that went into my thigh.
It wasn't a body part.
When I was little.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a... slid underneath my cousin's bed while we were like playing, and he had like hardwood floors, so you could slide really well.
Yeah.
You know? And I almost always exclusively wore sweatpants, just like a sweat suit. So I went running into the room and went to slide under the bed, and I slid, and my probably 200 pound plus young body slid over a splinter in the wood on the floor, and was about probably about 3 inches of wood through my thigh.
Wow.
That was pretty rough.
Yikes.
And I got brought to the hospital, and I had, I don't know if you've ever played the board game Mousetrap.
Mm-hmm.
Where, yeah. And then it's kind of, what's it called? The type of machine.
Oh, I don't know. If you hadn't asked me, I would know.
Yeah. Whatever. It's the one where it's the, you know, I keep thinking Rorschach test, but it's not. Uh-huh. It starts with a G, I think. Anyways, it's the thing where, you know, you have a little, you drop a marble and then that hits a bell and this happens. Da, 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 da. The end result is this
Rube Goldberg.
Rube Goldberg. That's it. Goldberg. That's why I saw G. So the little net that falls, a little plastic cap that falls on the mouse, was used to hold my sweatpants up over the wound as I got brought to the hospital.
Ingenuity.
Yeah. Thanks, Dad. But and then that was fun too, because they numbed it up and I got to watch the doctor try to tear it out of my skin with just a pair of like medical pliers, I guess. And he didn't want to have to actually like cut it out, so he just tried to pull it out, and he pulled it and it snapped, and then he'd go in again and pull it out. And I don't recall ever feeling anything from it after the initial stabberoo. But yeah, I got to keep that in a little urine sample jar. And then I think I left it at my cousin's house. I don't know. Threw it away at some point. I feel like there was other bits and pieces of my body that I tried to keep and I wasn't able to.
I don't know. I was going to ask if I keep an IUD once, but then I was like, nah, that's weird. So I didn't.
Why? It's not weird. Well, it's weird, but that shouldn't be like... weird. So
I only half wanted to. I would have asked anyway, but I didn't really care that much. It was a thought.
Well,
was,
missed like, opportunity.
Yeah.
Well, that will do it for us this week for this entry. If you would like to reach out, feel free to do so. You can reach us on Twitter and Facebook at Macabrepedia.
Also on Instagram at MacabrepediaPod and email at MacabrepediaPod@gmail.com.
And thank you to all of our patrons over on Patreon. If you like what we do here, you can support us over there. It is $5. It is you can give whatever you like, but $5 will get you a couple extra episodes and a couple little tidbits. If you like bitting your tids, that's where you can do it over there on Patreon. And you can check us out over there, and that also gives you access to Discord, which occasionally has a few unusual conversations about, you know, wrestling and murders and Dungeons
people
and
named
Dragons.
Magic.
And percentage wise, it's mostly people with the nickname of Magic. But thank you as always, and join us next week as we add another entry into this hour. Macabrepedia.